Okay, again, we're going to be discussing the five pillars of Islam, and we've actually already made note of the first four. These are the fundamental requirements of the Islamic religion. In other words, what is required of the adherents to that religion. And just to make note of those five things, and we'll emphasize tonight in our discussion the fifth of the five. So I'm going to go very quickly over the first four. The first one is faith. And each of these have Arabic terms that are associated with them. But when you refer to faith, there is a confession or a recitation that is required for an individual to be a Muslim. You've heard it many, many times that there is only one God, Allah, and that Muhammad is God's messenger. And it is commonly recited in Arabic, but it is something that is essential and is required for an individual to be converted to Islam. If they're unwilling to make that confession, they cannot be a Muslim. The second of those five pillars is prayer, and the prayer life of a Muslim is very rigid. It is ritualistic. It consists of five daily prayers. And of course, one of the interesting things, it's kind of an eerie thing too, but an interesting thing about the trip that I took to the Bible lands a number of years ago, there were a couple of times where we were in Palestinian territory. And on one occasion, it was at Jacob's Well, as we were at Jacob's Well. And so there are loudspeakers everywhere up on the poles, and there was the call to prayer that was given. And it's the Eastern style of music that would play over the loudspeakers to signify that it was time for the prayers to commence. And this is something that is typical in the Muslim life. And so there are five set times for prayer: dawn, noon, afternoon, evening, and night. All the prayers are recited while facing in the direction of the Kaaba, which is that central edifice, that cube-like structure in the middle of that sacred temple in Mecca. And these prayers are said in various set positions. So the actual whether you're standing, sitting, kneeling, that is a part of this whole practice, and so it has to be done in a particular way. The third is almsgiving, and that is the practice of charitable giving. And if you'll remember, this is obligatory to all who have means, and the idea is that you give back to your community. And so individuals who have gained materially through trade, merchandising, those kinds of things, that if you take money from the community, that you have a responsibility to give back a portion of that money to the community of which you are a part. And that is to be distributed in that fashion. The fourth is fasting. And the ritual fasting includes an obligatory fast during Ramadan, which is one of the periods of... basically, it's a period of self-denial that the Muslims involve themselves in. They abstain from food and drink from dawn to dusk through the month, and are to be especially mindful of other aspects of proper living, so that they're to be nicer to people, they're to refrain from violence, anger, envy, greed, profanity, those kinds of things during that month. It's supposed to be a special holy month, a month of self-denial. So that's something that is required of all Muslims, except for those with regard to the fasting who would be damaged by a fast, such as pregnant women or individuals who are ill or have some kind of medical condition that would preclude the fast. And by the way, the fast is not, a complete fast. It's abstaining from food and drink from dawn until dusk. So you cannot eat during the day. Then the fifth, and this is where we kind of got to in our study last week and wasn't able to really explain fully what, or 2 weeks ago, what went on with regard to the pilgrimage or the Hajj. And this pilgrimage is something that all Muslims must do in a particular month of the year, at least once in their lifetime. And basically, all Muslims are supposed to go to Mecca at least once in their lifetime. And this pilgrimage is not just getting there, but it's a number of actions that are symbolic of certain important events in the theology of the Islamic faith that is basically ritualized and remembered by this particular pilgrimage. So there are a couple of things that are done. I'll give you just the example, or just read through as quickly as possible these things. The one that we mentioned 2 weeks ago was that when they get to this place at Mecca, they have to walk 7 times around the Kaaba. And again, remembering that there are over 1 million people that come to these pilgrimages at one time. And this is basically a 2 to 3 day event. Most of it's done in a 2 day period. It makes it a little bit more difficult than just walking around a small building, because you have millions of Muslims that are trying to do the same thing at the same time. And so it's not uncommon to see on the nightly news during this pilgrimage all of these Muslims gathered together in this courtyard. And it's an amazing sight to see. But anyway, the Kaaba is a cube-shaped building at the center of the most sacred mosque there in Mecca. And what they are to do, number one, is to walk 7 times around it. The second thing they're to do is to touch the black stone. The black stone is a stone that is located on the east corner of that building, the Kaaba. And so this stone must be touched by each pilgrim. And this stone is significant because it supposedly is a stone that came from heaven, a stone that was sent by God to Adam and Eve in the very beginning as an altar. And this is the claim that is made concerning this stone, that it was from the very beginning, that it was a stone that came down from God, and it was a stone that was set into the Kaaba by Muhammad himself. And so it is a religious relic that they are to touch. Again, when I see these kinds of things, I see some similarities to practices in other religions. And just to give as an example, it's a common practice for Catholics if they make a pilgrimage or a trip to St. Peter's Basilica in Rome, which is the cathedral that was erected at Vatican City. It's a real tourist location there at Vatican City. And as you're going out of the main basilica into the Sistine Chapel, the little hallway that you go from the basilica into the Sistine Chapel, there is an onyx statue, a black onyx statue of Peter. And Catholics, and I don't know that it's required of Catholics, but it is the common practice of Catholics, as they go by that statue, to kiss the foot of Peter. And that onyx statue of Peter. And so it was kind of an interesting thing. I did have, when I was graduating, after graduating high school, I got to go to Italy and went and saw these things. And there was a long line of Catholics that were just lined up as they were passing by, and each of them were kissing the foot of this black statue. And the foot, I mean, it was an elevated statue, and the foot was right about here. And I had read about in some of the literature that was found there that the statue's foot had been replaced, a half a dozen times over the centuries because it had worn down, and they had to basically rebuild the foot because it had gotten worn off because of the evolutions of these people. So that's a kind of a common type of thing that you'll see in the rituals. In fact, some of the other world religions, you'll see the same kind of thing. So that's the second thing they do. The third thing that they have to do is travel 7 times between 2 mountains. They're not really mountains, they're hills. When you hear of Mount Safa and Mount Marwa, we're talking about basically hills and valleys. If you hear the word defile, or a name that has the word defile before it, a defile is a valley. And we may make reference to that in a few moments. Well, the reason why they make this trek between these two hills, and they do it 7 times during their pilgrimage, is because it is a part of Islamic tradition that Abraham was commanded by God to leave his wife Hagar and their infant son, Ishmael, alone in the desert between those two mountains or hills with only basic provisions, and it was a test of their faith. And so when they ran out of the provisions, they had no more food and water, Hagar went in search of help or to find some water somewhere. And so she first climbed Safah to look over that area to see if anyone was coming. When she saw nothing, she went to the other hill to look around. And so while she was at the hillsides, up on the hill, she could see Ishmael as he was between. She could see and see that he was safe. But while she's in the valley down at the bottom, she couldn't see him. So she would run until she got to where she was elevated enough to where she could see him. And so she traveled back and forth between the hills 7 times in the scorching heat before returning to her son. When she arrived, she found, when she arrived that 7th time back to her son, supposedly an angel by the name of Jibril, and I'm not sure if that's the Arabic for Gabriel or not, but the angel Jibril hit the ground with his wing and a spring came forth. So that's the Islamic tradition. It's now known as the Zamzam well or Zamzam well, and that was the sustenance and reward to Hagar as a result of her patience and her faith. So that's what supposedly happened with regard to Hagar, and this is something that all Muslims are to do as a part of that pilgrimage. Now the last one, I think it is the last one in this list, is the most interesting to me at least, and that is the stoning of the devil in Mina. And what's this? This is a ritual that they engage in. And what the pilgrims do is they throw rocks, pebbles, at 3 walls at Mina. And this is a short distance away from the mosque in Mecca. So they throw these pebbles at the wall, and these are symbolic of Abraham's pilgrimage. And as a part of his Hajj or his pilgrimage, he was tempted to disobey God for the purpose of preserving Ishmael. Now, in the Muslim religion, it's not Isaac who was offered up as the sacrifice, or who was given that, or where Abraham was given the instructions to offer up Isaac as sacrifice, but rather Ishmael was the one that was offered up. And so this is representative of the devil tempting Abraham not to do that. And there are basically three pillars that were erected to signify the stoning of the devil, because Abraham received directions to pelt or to stone the devil as a part of this temptation. I'll explain it in just a few moments. The interesting thing about this, at one time there were 3 pillars that had been erected at this location for the Muslims to throw the pebbles. The problem is, when you got millions of people throwing rocks, that the pebbles would be missed. And people on the other side who were throwing rocks would get hit with the pebbles. And so it was causing problems. And so they took down the pillars and they erected 3 walls. And now there are 3 separate walls and you throw rocks at the walls. And that's again representative of this. So the 10th day of the month, the pilgrims strike the largest wall with 7 pebbles. After he finishes this stoning, this symbolic stoning, he has to cut or shave his hair. And I'm assuming that her as well, but just every pilgrim must cut or shave their hair. On each of the following 2 days, they must hit each of the 3 walls with 7 pebbles going in order from east to west. Thus, at least 49 pebbles are needed for the ritual, more if some throws miss. And if the pilgrims stay an extra day at Mina, they have to again stone each wall 7 times. The pebbles used in the stoning, I'll read this very quickly, are traditionally gathered at a plain southeast of Mina on the night before the first throwing, but can be collected at Mina. The ritual reenacts Abraham's pilgrimage to Mecca. When he left Mina, this is the story, as one related it. As he left Mina, he was brought down to a valley, the defile called Al-Aqaba, and the devil appeared to him at stone heap of the defile. Gabriel said to him, to Abraham, pelt him. So Abraham threw 7 stones at him so that he disappeared from him. Then he appeared to him at the middle stone heap, and Gabriel said to him, pelt him. So he pelted him with 7 stones so that he disappeared from him. Then he appeared to him at the little stone heap, and Gabriel said to him, pelt him. And he pelted him with 7 stones like the little stones for throwing with a sling. So the devil withdrew from him. All 3 pillars represent the devil. The first and largest represents his temptation of Abraham against sacrificing Ishmael. The second represents the temptation of Abraham's wife Hagar to induce her to stop him. And the third represents his temptation of Ishmael to avoid being sacrificed. He was rebuked each time. The devil was rebuked each time, and the throwing of the stone symbolized those rebukes. So that's, again, this is when you see on the news this being done, the ritualistic nature of what it is that they're doing, this is the reason behind it. And I thought that was at least interesting to note that that this kind of ritual, which is something that I think is in no way appealing to us. But I do want you to understand something. The Christian faith, there are some alterations with regard to our interaction with Jehovah God as a result of the new covenant. Some of the things that are done here are similar to certain actions that were done by the Jews with regard to the sacrifice in the temple, with regard to the erecting of altars at significant places during the patriarchal dispensation. All of those kinds of practices we can see in the Bible as well. Even when you find, for example, the refusal of the Jew as a result of Old Testament instruction to eat unclean meat, some of the ritualistic cleansing that you saw being practiced in the first century, those kinds of things are things that Jesus alluded to, but he altered with regard to the Christian faith. When he said things such as, what goes into the mouth does not defile the body, but what goes out of the mouth is what defiles the body. Or Peter's vision that he had in Acts the 10th chapter before going to Cornelius, when that great blanket was let down from heaven, that great sheet was let down from heaven, and there were animals of all types, both clean and unclean. He was given instruction, rise, Peter, kill and eat. Peter said, not so, my mouth has not touched any unclean thing. And he said, what I have cleansed, you must not call unclean or common. And so these kinds of things were a practice of the old covenant as well. These ritualistic things were done for a specific purpose. I had an opportunity to hear Jeremiah preach in Ranger, and his lesson was on the holiness of God. And he went through and discussed some of the rituals of the Old Testament, which were all designed to establish that as we go before God, we must respect God as holy. And we must recognize that when we are in His presence, that we are on holy ground. The burning bush, you'll remember, is an example of that. That where you are standing is holy ground. And it was something that was a part of that religion, the Judaism, to teach and to establish those particular practices. And so that was practiced up into the first century. And Jesus did away with much of that, indicating that, that again, uncleanness and is to be correlated with sin rather than any physical impurities, and that righteousness is not through ritual purification but rather through godly living. And so there is a distinction that's made. So what we practice religiously today, we understand it goes beyond the mere ritual. And that's one of the objections that I have, one of the biggest objections that I have to the practice of Catholicism, because it's so involved in ritualism, which has little effect on the exercise of godliness, and something is antithetical to this call to the Christian faith of which we're a part. And yet, when we look at these things, we make fun of that, but I just do want you to recognize that there is much that is similar to that in the Old Testament, and it was for a specific purpose, and that was so that we would recognize the holiness of God. And those things, those lessons are taught, and we can learn from them as well. But that kind of ritualism is something that is a part of the Islamic religion. And that's a very important part of it, is that Hajj or pilgrimage to Mecca. Okay, anybody have any questions before we finish up our study of Islam? Yes, Roger.
Your study said it was in that...
The Kabbalah. No, I don't know. I don't know what's in the central in the building, the Kabbalah. I don't know. I guess. See, what you're going to find are real big holes in my knowledge of any of these things, and please understand that. But what you can do is you can go to the internet and type in Kabbalah in Google, and you can read all day long and get a lot of information. So if there's anything like this that has piqued your curiosity, then feel free to do that. And hopefully it will be beneficial to you. I think that when we read these kinds of things, that the true faith, as we worship Jesus Christ as the way, the truth, and the life, that is something that stands out in stark relief to much of what you're going to be looking at for the remainder of this time tonight and next week as well. The superstitions and the peculiarities of those religions are something that often, to me, it seems very much a distortion of the true faith in God, or what God has revealed to us. Anybody else? Okay, I just want to very quickly make just note of a couple of other points that are found at the end. First of all, Muslims believe in a bodily resurrection and eternal salvation. It is not by the concept of grace. It's rather by works of merit. If Allah wills to forgive your sins and Allah desires for you to be saved, then you will be saved. And of course, you know, with regard to Islamic extremism, the idea that, you know, if I drive this truck into a building and it blows up, that I'm going to be rewarded with the 70 virgins and so on and so forth. That's kind of the concept of, by doing what are considered by a Muslim in a particular context as good deeds. What is taught in the Quran is good deeds, that it is upon that basis that God will determine whether or not to forgive you of your sinfulness and unrighteousness and grant you interest into I think it's referred to in English paradise, if I remember correctly, is the reference that is made there. As a part of the Muslim faith, diet is restricted. Pork, blood, carrion, which that's basically dead animals, not those who are killed for eating, but animals that you find that are dead, and alcohol are all prohibited. Food that is permissible to Muslims is referred to as halal food. And it's kind of an interesting thing. I was reading some of these other religions, and some of these other religions' restrictions are made against any food that is prepared, the meat, for example, that is prepared as halal food. Because the method of the bleeding of the animal so that it can be accepted as halal, or accepted as valid to be eaten. Well, I'm having trouble with that. Be eaten by a Muslim. Well, that kind of death causes suffering for the animal. And so you have some of the Eastern religions who say if you kill an animal in that way, you can't eat it. It's forbidden to eat it because that's too hard on the animal. And so it's kind of an interesting thing. But the significance of that is that the animal must be bled, because the eating of blood is prohibited in Islam. And as a result of that, the food has to be prepared in a particular way. So if you hear about that, in fact, you have, again, where there are many Muslims, there will be concessions that are made, sometimes by restaurants, sometimes by schools, with regard to the dietary practices in various school systems and such, in order to accommodate Muslims, because they will only eat halal food, or food that is prepared in a particular way. Yes, Ron?
I think nowadays that halal food is not prepared in the clean manuals. Halal refers to their spiritual preparedness. It's really nasty stuff.
It's not. When you read about the practices, it can be a little bit distasteful, especially for our sensibilities. Okay, a couple of other things very quickly. A caliphate, you hear the word caliphate, that has reference, and we already made the point, but it's in the material. It's a theocracy. So when you hear the Islamic State, ISIS, what they are claiming is that by taking control of this particular land, they have established a caliphate. And now there are many Muslims that are against that, against them and against that. But the claim is that they are establishing what is a caliphate, which was the practice. Muhammad established the first caliphate, and then there were others that were established through the history of Islam. And it is a theocracy, and the other aspect of that is the Sharia law, which you hear about. Should we have Sharia law? Should we allow Sharia law in certain places in America and such? And this Sharia law is the law of the Muslim, based upon the Quran, but it involves much more than simply the teachings in the Quran. But it is basically the judicial system of a caliphate. So when you have individuals who are advocating the practice of Sharia law, what they are seeking to do is to establish a caliphate, a Muslim theocracy. And then finally, radical or militant Islam is expansionist, as we have seen, and of course becomes evident just recently with regard to the attacks in Paris and the struggles that we find between the secular countries and ISIS. And so a militant Muslim takes jihad, the word jihad, to be interpreted literally as a physical struggle against those who are the enemies of Islam. Who are the enemies of Islam? For the radical Islamists, the enemies are Islam, of Islam are those who will not convert to Islam. Having reference to those who are secular, those who are the people of the book, which has reference to those who are Christians, and anyone that does not accept Sharia law. They're considered enemies of Islam. And that's why you have radical or extreme Islam that is basically incompatible with the view that Western society holds toward secular government. And that's why this conflict continues and has continued for centuries. You can go back. It's interesting. And you read about these kinds of things. And I recognize there are extreme views on in each direction with regard to these things. But when you go to some of our founding fathers and read some of the quotes from them, there was the recognition, 250 years ago, of the dangers of the Muslim Islam faith. I didn't call them Muslims at the time, but there is that problem because of the I say militant. We could also say those who will interpret the concept of jihad as a physical struggle. That's something that has been prevalent at different times in the history of the Islamic religion. So that there has always been this kind of conflict between them and those who aren't Islamic. And no doubt it will continue. As far as it kind of rises and falls, ebbs and then comes back. But that conflict is going to continue. So Islam is the most prominent of all man-made religions. We say that in the sense of adherence. It is second only to those who claim to be Christians with regard to the number of adherents. And as a result of that, it is a very influential force in the world today. Okay, purposely, I mean, I've got my opinions with regard to Islam. It's a false religion. I certainly think that Islam extremism that exists in our society is extremely dangerous and needs to be dealt with. But that wasn't the purpose of this particular. It was simply to give you the basics of the religion. Anybody have any comments, questions about what we've discussed in these last several weeks? Yes.
You might have said that some or not all that we're looking for a climatic event from the end of time and all, especially about Iran. And so they want to bother you with Iran because they're going to bring it about and return to someone today. You familiar with that?
Yeah, there are some apocalyptic aspects, but I'm not sufficiently familiar with how many or who think of that. So I don't have any information on it. Just that there is some of those influences.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that I've noticed in looking at some of these things, it's the case with with, in fact, on the back of the next handout with the Zoroastrianism. I've got to look at it before I pronounce it. It's pronounced the way it looks, but it's a long word, so it's sometimes. But the eschatology of that particular religion, which is a very, very obscure religion in our day and time. There's only a couple hundred thousand people that are adherents to it, and they're all in India now. But it reads like premillennial doctrine. You know how the premillennialists will take the apocalyptic language of Revelation and they'll attribute that to literal physical conflict. There's going to be there's going to be the Armageddon, and there's going to be, you know, the literal blood that will be as deep as the bridles of the horses, and there's going to be this great conflict between good and evil that will signify the end times. Well, the Zoroastrians, I think that's the way they're termed, Zoroastrians, they believe that kind of stuff with regard to end times. And of course, the Muslim, the extremist, the fundamentalist with regard to Islam theology, they have those same kinds of views, that there's going to be this conflict between good and evil, good being Islam, evil being everybody else, and it's going to ultimately end with the establishment of this glorious Islamic state on earth. And so it's kind of an eschatology that they hold to that's very literal as well. So you see those kinds of things. You have, of course, you have many Muslims who are more secular in their leanings and attitudes, that they want to just live and let live, you know, and they're not the ones causing the problems, but they exist as well. All right, anybody else? All right.